Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Back with more Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Umat in the studio. We have Dr. Dan Nelson, and right now talking with Dr. Ken Pentland. He is our gut specialist. We have Carol on the line, and we're talking about prebiotics and probiotics and what can be done for that slow motility.
Right. We were talking about a specific probiotic supplement. And just to mention quickly the difference between a prebiotic and a probiotic. Probiotics are actually species of bacteria that supplement the species in the microbiome that's currently there. A prebiotic is a substance that supports the increase of the number of bacteria in your system, like a soluble fiber, like inulin or potato starch or something like that.
It's the food that the bacteria eat.
Yep.
The prebiotics is basically food for the gut bacteria.
Right. And some
feed the bugs.
Exactly.
Yeah, feed the bugs.
So that's one of the benefits.
Feed the bugs, good food.
That's
here
right.
We are.
That's right.
That's one of the many benefits of fiber, right? Soluble fiber helps to feed the good bacteria, which support gut function overall. Just before the break, we mentioned another supplement, Trifala, which is
Can you spell that again, please?
Yeah, it's Triphala, and it's from the Ayurvedic medical tradition in India, and it's three fruits basically, and it's people take it.
My
just
grandparents for used to take it.
Right.
There you go.
It's
like
very
that.
Common.
It's
very common. My grandparents used to take it.
Yeah. So we don't just want to. Keep, you know, move things out. We also want to support gut health, you know, as it is. And this is one of the things that supports the gut lining. Another thing that I would recommend is marshmallow root.
Okay.
Oh, wow. I've never even heard of that. That's new to me. Marshmallow root.
Yeah,
really?
People hear the word marshmallow and they think hot chocolate. But
yes.
Yeah.
No, or s'mores. Or s'mores.
So it's actually the stuff you put in hot chocolate is named after a plant. Marsh as in swamp and mallow as in plant. And it's a root that has it's a plant that has a root that looks like what we call marshmallows. But that's where marshmallows came from.
So is it white?
Oh, okay.
It is white. Yeah.
Wow.
But it creates like a mucilage. It's kind of like putting aloe vera on a sunburn when you take it.
Oh.
It's good for the colon. It reduces inflammation.
That sounds helpful.
Right. So those are the three things I would think
so
about.
So prebiotic, probiotic, Trifala, and marshmallow root.
Yes.
Okay.
And that comes
good.
In capsule
Very
form.
Very good information. Yeah.
Now, when they're in capsule form, if you, like for a person like her, can you open them and put it in
Absolutely.
A drink?
Absolutely.
Okay, because I'm always kind of like, I don't know.
But kind of like Metamucil, it will probably tend to gel up in liquid, so... But maybe you can mix it in applesauce or something like that.
Uh-huh. Okay. That's a good suggestion. Oh, well, I really appreciate the doctor's encouragement about it being something that's not the mother's fault or a person's fault that's taking care, because it is hard to see someone have a continuing difficulty, and you're trying to do everything you can. I appreciate that. And then I also appreciate Dr. Pentland. These are suggestions that I haven't heard before. And the probiotic and the prebiotic I've heard about, but I didn't understand that one's the species and the other supports it or gives increases it. The prebiotic allows them to have something to eat. Increases it in the gut. So to me, those are very, very good suggestions, and they're new ideas. Would I ask the doctor for these supplements, or are they something that you can buy?
Yeah, those are things you can buy over the counter. Local supplement stores or online. You should be able to find them pretty easily.
All right. Okay. Well, you've given me a lot of assistance, and I needed it, so thank you.
You're welcome, Carol, and all the best to you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, thank you, Carol, for that. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine. This is the number to get through with your questions, 800-465-8770. And while we're on the topic of gut health, Dr. Pentland, what's new and what should we be aware of?
Well, since we're sort of on the theme of heart health, I wanted to mention a little bit about the intersection between heart health and gut health.
Really? Okay, so they...
Because everything comes back to the gut for me.
Okay, yes, yes. We want to know more.
So, yeah, we were joking with him about that. We were saying, what was it that I said? The heart doesn't live in Ohio and the kidneys don't live in London. Yeah. We all live in the same place.
All in the same.
Right. But, you know, I believe good health begins in the gut. But the heart is a very important organ, and one of the areas where gut health can affect, and when I say gut, I mean the whole gastrointestinal system, which actually starts at the mouth, right? And the mouth, actually, oral care is connected intimately to heart health. There's a very famous statistic out there that 50% of heart attacks are related to periodontal disease, right? And there's other studies that correlate arrhythmias with oral infection, right? So the mechanism is either pathogens are having access directly to the circulation or they're increasing inflammatory chemicals in the circulation, right? So that can affect cardiovascular health. Another area for cardiovascular health is fiber, right? We were just talking about fiber improving gut bacteria, but it also helps regulate cholesterol levels. It improves varicosity of veins. It reduces varicose veins. And it helps regulate blood sugar and blood pressure.
And that's just fiber?
Just fiber.
Boy, that's an important thing, right?
It's a huge...
Lynette, longevity patients know that.
That's right. You sprinkle it on our food.
That's right.
That's what we do.
When you think fiber, you think Metamucil in a glass of water and drinking sludge, but it doesn't have to be like that.
No. The doctors have me put, you know, sprinkling it on my food. But I didn't realize that it did more than just one or two things.
It's like a Leatherman tool of supplements.
Yeah. You know, as our knowledge about the gut microbiome has increased, we do recognize that there's a lot of influence in appropriate gut health, not just for gut purposes, but for, like Dr. Pentland mentions, heart today, but even in your brain health. They call the gut the second brain of the body. And so taking care of your gut is really very important if you want to optimize your health. And I think that's what Dr. Pentland here is pointing out to us today, that it begins not just in the GI system, in the small and the large bowels, but it begins really in the mouth. And paying attention to oral hygiene is very important, which sometimes we don't do or we forget or we don't know, but there is enough literature to say that periodontal disease actually correlates with cardiovascular disease. And so if you pay attention to your oral health and your oral microbiome, yes, there is such a thing, then you can actually have better heart health is what we're saying. So if your teeth and your dentition is poor, then the likelihood of you having heart disease is higher.
Everything's combined.
That's right.
Wow.
It's all connected. We all live together.
It is all connected. All right. Thank you for that, Dr. Pentland. If you have questions about your gut health, your heart, aging, whatever, pain management, today is the day to call in. We have three doctors in the studio, Dr. Umat, Dr. Dan Nelson, and Dr. Pentland. And we're going to Tacoma now. John has a question for the doctors. Hi there, John, and welcome.
Hello, John. How can we help?
Hi. Well, I've been a patient at Longevity for 10 years or so.
Wonderful.
And I'm in Tacoma now. And I'm also a cancer smorgasbord, and I'm getting to fight melanoma now.
Okay.
But before that, I had prostate cancer.
Okay.
And I got some good advice from you guys as to how to deal with it, and it was successful.
Okay. I'm happy to hear that.
And so at first they did the CyberKnife, and that was, I thought it was really good, but they said, wait a minute, one more thing. We have to put in radiation seeds for 10 minutes. And, my PSA was going down already, but anyway, they did it. But when they did it, they were hammering them in. And I said, you're hitting something. And, of course, they just said, we're doing it. So they hit some more. And basically they wiped out my nerves. So that you could have gone in with a wire cutter and snipped everything off, and I wouldn't have even noticed it. But things are coming back. But one of the issues that's remained is, particularly at night, I have to get up every hour to hour and a half and go pee a significant amount of pee. So I've heard about the existence of the different treatments that you guys have, and I'm just wondering if somebody who's, done prostate treatment, they didn't do any surgery or anything, but peeing at night is kind of annoying for me and my wife. So that's sort of the start of the conversation.
Okay. I'll let Dr. Pentland talk about the Viasure for a minute, and then I have a thought.
Okay.
Right. So, when we talk about urination, the benign prostate hypertrophy is one of the things that we talk about, and the Viasure can help with that. However, it's not practical for all sort of conditions where urination is affected. It's a practical or useful for conditions where the prostate is affecting urination. If it's the bladder, that's a different story, right? So if the nerves that are innervating the bladder is causing hypocontraction of the bladder, then urination probably will not improve with Viasure. Okay. But it does help with prostate affecting the bladder.
Okay. So that's an important distinction. So, John, my thought is progesterone. And I don't know if you are on progesterone therapy or not, but progesterone helps improve sleep quality. And a lot of times, if we just help our patients sleep better, they are finding they don't have to get up as much at night. And so it might be useful to think about that. And if you will maybe call the Tacoma team on Monday and have your doctor send me an email, I can give them more specific details about what my thoughts are regarding your case after I've had a chance to look at your chart and talk to your doctor. Okay?
Okay, well, I actually am taking progesterone.
Okay, then I'll just take a look at the numbers, and I'll take a look at the route of administration. We might be able to tweak that.
Okay, so no clear.
Okay, the other thought is actually maybe also with rapamycin, and I don't, there's no clear literature here, but we do have anecdotal reports from several patients now that rapamycin has helped them improve with urinary output. So, again, it's not the indication for the drug, but there are a couple of things that might be possible.
So it sounds like there could be some options for you, John.
I bought $300 worth of rapamycin, and then the cancer guys for the melanoma said, "No, don't take it."
I see. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Well. Okay. Those are my thoughts at this time. But if you want to just reach out through your Tacoma doctors, then I can maybe troubleshoot a little bit with them specifically about your case.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Good luck, John. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for the call, John. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine. We're glad you're here this morning. If you've got a question, now is the time to call. Don't wait until the very end of the show. Here's that number to get through. The phone lines are open for you at 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. Susie, we're going to talk to you next. Stay right there. Leading Edge Medicine continues in just a moment. It's Leading Edge Medicine. Good morning. It's April, the first show in April. That's right. I forgot about that.
That's right. Last weekend was Easter, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. Hope everybody had a good Easter.
Oh, we did.
It was. It was nice. A nice weather, for one thing. That was
so
nice.
Fun. Yeah.
Had a and little. The tulips are in full spring.
They are. Yes. Boom. They're looking
full
gorgeous.
I have not
Skagit
gone.
Skagit Valley.
I would love to go.
I always miss that. I have to go late.
Yes. And you still have time. Yeah,
now, now's the time.
50% in bloom.
There's crowds. Yeah.
Yes.
It's just busy. That's all.
Yeah. It gets busy, but it's worth it. It's so beautiful. Oh, I just love it. Yeah. Right. I've gone every year with my kids since they started the Tulip Festival. So
really?
That's been about 30 some odd years.
Oh, wow.
And now my grown daughters invited me to go this past week. And then we took the four grandkids. And I was like, oh, this is so sweet. You know, the kids running through the fields, getting in trouble and, you know, grabbing a tulip. It's like, no, no, you can't pick these. But I was the Nana, so I just got to enjoy and smile and go, oh, yeah, I remember. And the moms were frantically, so very beautiful.
That was me many years ago.
Yes, so fun. Highly recommend the Skagit Valley Tulip Festival. Go in the next couple of weeks. So there you go. I was not paid for this endorsement. All right. We're going to go to Gig Harbor. I bet they've got tulips and daffodils there. Do they, Susie? Susie on the line.
Hello, Susie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, there's daffodils and tulips popping up all over. And
wonderful. Spring is springing.
It's good.
Oh, yes. Beautiful. How can we help?
I'm calling about my husband, 88 years of age, longevity patient for 22 years.
Wow.
He's had a very active lifestyle, very active lifestyle. He's a veterinarian and understands medicine. We're both medical. Mm-hmm. He has scoliosis, now constant chronic pain. Mm-hmm. He's had all sorts of workups. PET scan recently was clear. He's had an ablation. His pain scale would be on a scale maybe of 5 to 6. He's had spinal x-rays. He has a 2-inch deviation with an S-curve in his spine that he gained as a young child. He has the results of those x-rays are spondylosis and osteoarthritis. Mm. The problem is he can't stand up straight without pain. He's been on no pain meds all his life because he wanted to maintain a lucid lifestyle that would not deteriorate his outlook in any way. He's been recently taken off Celebrex. That was one a day that he took, but he has been placed on gabapentin 200 milligrams at HS.
Okay.
What our question is there any relief through stem cells or other treatment modalities? There's just not a lot of hope out there for him to receive pain relief that we know about, and we'd like to question the doctors there for whatever they might suggest.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wonderful description, so thank you for that. And so for the listening audience, let me just kind of go over a few things that you mentioned a little too quickly. First of all, it's called, you know, you gave a great description. Thank you. That really helps us a lot.
Right.
But you talked about, first of all, 88 years old and then with scoliosis. So that has been a long time. And for those that are listening to the show, it's basically a curvature of the spine that then impacts on the muscles and the muscle nerve relationships and can cause abnormal muscle spasms. And then people just get used to it over time, but sometimes it can be a difficulty in managing them with their pain, especially if, you know, two vertebrae are kind of crunching on each other as part of that scoliosis. And so the amount of that curvature might be important, and Dr. Nelson will maybe talk a little bit more about that and what has been done to stabilize that in the past and or plans for the future moving forward. The second thing you mentioned was with pain score was 5 to 6 out of 10. So that is something that we always ask our patients, that on a normal day to day, what is your worst pain out of 10? And so you mentioned 5 to 6. So thank you for telling us, because that is significant. Mm-hmm. That means that he is in a lot of pain on a day to day basis. And I assume that something that aggravates it will cause it to get worse. And then maybe on a better day, it's a little less, but on average, it's still pretty significant. And then you mentioned the most important thing, that it's impacting on his ability to function and his medication, Celebrex being gone, and gabapentin. Gabapentin can really affect his neurological function depending upon the dose. So, Dr. Nelson, given all of that, not an easy solution here, but he is a longevity patient for 22 years. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, well, it's hard to, until I see the x-ray in front of me, it's kind of hard. And then you did mention, I think, Susie, that he had an ablation, so he must have had like some facet injections and somebody went after it. So I assume he had a medial branch radiofrequency and ablation where we're treating the facet pain. Is that what he had done?
Yes, that is. And he had that, and it gave him relief. He could stand up straight. Gave him relief for a month, maybe.
Okay.
Not much. He's had some
pretty disappointing.
Very disappointing.
And where is the pain? Is it lumbar, lumbosacral, you know, low back, mid back?
It's low thoracic and tired. Lumbar, just right in there.
Okay. So, you know, the first thing we'd have to do, when I see a patient like this, I look at the x-rays. The degree of scoliosis is obviously important. But then we have to, often I'll take them into our procedure room and under live fluoroscopy kind of map out their pain. Say, okay, this looks, do you feel it here? Where's the top of the pain? Where's the bottom of the pain? And then that's important because... you know, we have to know where the pain generators are in the spine. Because
right.
The x-rays and MRIs give us a lot of good information, but we don't have a good scan for pain, right?
Yeah.
We don't have a pain scan. We only rely on people's feedback when we're doing like our exam or, the first thing I tell a patient, point to where the center of the pain is, right? And then we examine them. But the fluoroscopic x-ray, I call it a fluoroscopic survey, where I'm actually there and we're looking under live fluoro, where the pain begins, ends, where's the worst part of it, so I get a better idea. The thing is, I would have to know, you know, was the ablation things important? Typically if we do a radiofrequency ablation, we expect 6 months to a year or longer of pain relief before those nerves grow back and we have to repeat it. So that's a little disappointing, but, you know, we see that sometimes.
That doesn't mean that he's not a candidate for another trial, does it?
For trial injections?
Ablation procedure.
Possibly. I'd have to look at the notes, see where it was done, and see. Because I see that all the time where ablations were done, and I look at the patient and I think, well, I think that was in the wrong location.
Okay.
According to what I see. But, you know, the other thing, well, let's assume for the moment that it was done in the proper location and it failed. I mean, a month is really not a very good response.
Right.
So you mentioned stem cell injections. I mean, obviously we do that for spinal pain, but for facet arthropathy or facet pain is a very common source of back pain, and those patients respond amazingly well to stem cell injections, and it can be a game changer.
Yeah.
Now I'm saying that without having obviously seen.
I mean, she said osteoarthritis, but we don't know where it's affecting.
Right.
Is it the facet or not?
We don't know if it's a facet. There's other pain generators in the spine. There's vertebrogenic pain, which is the main part, but we also have something to treat that. So Yeah, it's finding where the pain's actually coming from. Mm-hmm. And that really takes some, that's not something you can just look at and actually.
You have to be a detective.
You do. It's a little sleuthing, which I love to do. I love, you know, figuring these things out because that's what makes the job interesting for me. So I don't know I've been kind of rambling, Susie. Is that helpful?
Is the first visit covered by insurance if she came and brought him for a consultation?
It is. It is. That's great question. And if we have to do any additional testing, sometimes, a lot of times I'll get an MRI from an outside, well, I shouldn't say this, but a lot of my MRIs I see in are not very good quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm partial to we have our own MRI machine at Pro Ortho, and they do an excellent job, especially when it comes to the spine. You know, sometimes I tell patients,
I mean, he has scoliosis, so, there is a problem there already. So taking a good quality scan of any kind is not going to be easy.
Right. But that's okay. If scoliosis, we can still get some pretty good images on MR to look, because it's important to look at, you know, how much arthritis is in the facet joints, to what's happening in the vertebral bodies. Does he have what we call modic changes on MRI, which indicate that he might have pain coming from the vertebral body or the big bones? Those are things we have to look at.
And so what I'm hearing you say is you can specifically say that, you know, this is where I'm homing in, this is what I want to see.
Right. These are we try to, line up the usual suspects: facet pain, vertebrogenic pain, disc pain. It sounds like he doesn't have any radiating leg pain, though. It's all localized in the spine, Susie?
He has no radiating leg pain, although his legs are getting weaker. His energy level is worn down by that pain.
Right. And then the other thing... The other thing we'd have to look for is any spinal stenosis, and that requires an MRI. You can't really see that on X-ray, but if he's having progressive weakness, we'd have to look for spinal stenosis, which is narrowing of the spinal canal, either the central canal or the neural foramen where the nerves come out of the spine. So those are all things that we have to look at in a situation like
this. Would this be, Dr. Nelson, would this be a two-day look-see? Can you do this all in one day, living in Harbor?
No, can't do it in one day. But we can't do it in one day, but we can get the process started. We can certainly get x-rays on the first visit. Sometimes I go upstairs and I sweet talk the MRI people. I can get the MRI done on the same day. They get tired of me seeing me sometimes. But
no.
That's, usually if a patient is on Medicare, that doesn't require pre-authorization, and we can get an MRI on the same day, which is fantastic.
Perfect.
And that we can get a lot done. And then, subsequently in Gig Harbor, sometimes we might have to do like a telehealth visit, like a follow-up visit via telehealth to save that drive. If we're just going over stuff like findings or kind of a progress report after a procedure, then. So we try to help out on people that are coming from a ways out.
Well, we appreciate that. The main thing is, at the end of the day, no matter what he has scoliosis and he has pain, and that's not a very comfortable look into the future, because we need medication to relieve that or whatever.
But there's a lot of hope. He has hope. There's things we can do.
Okay. We'll give you a call. What is your phone number at your clinic?
All right. I'll give you that right now before we go to the break. All right. To reach Dr. Dan Nelson and his amazing team at Pro Ortho, here is the number to call. It's 425-823-4000. Okay, I'll give you that number again. His website is also danielnelsonmd.com. That's another way to contact him at Pro Ortho. Again, the phone number for Dr. Dan Nelson at Pro Ortho is 425-823-4000. We'll take a quick break here, and we're back with Ben and Jackie and more questions for Dr. Pentland, Dr. Nelson, and Dr. Umat. This is Leading Edge Medicine. We'll be right back.
I'm picking up vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
And we're back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. Oh, boy, if you've got a question for the doctors, right now is the time to call 800-465-8770. We are going to head right over to Seattle. Ben is on the line. Hi there, Ben. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. I have a bone-related question. I will just read the x-ray report, a few lines, and then tell you what I'm concerned about, and if Dr. Nelson can talk to me about it, I'd appreciate it. I had an XR hip right, 2 and 3 views x-ray on Friday. The impression was a vascular necrosis of the femoral heads bilaterally. No evidence of articular flattening. And then the findings were there is subchondrial serpiginous scoliosis and adjacent lucency involving the femoral heads bilaterally. No articular flattening is seen. Joint spaces appear preserved. So what I'm concerned about is whether or not it may have been related to running. I've been running for 20 years, probably ran about 40,000 miles. Otherwise, I sit all day, and I'm wondering how severe this may be if there's no flattening and if the joint spaces are preserved. My vitamin D level is 37.3, and I'm wondering if I can continue my jogging career.
Boy, and, I'm loving the questions today.
Go ahead. Will help.
Good background.
Yeah, we're getting all kinds of information with, you know, succinct. You know, when you're doing rounds with your residents, this is a dream come true.
Yeah.
When the attending gets the whole information from the resident without having to ask for any more details.
Yeah, that's great.
And then you look at the resident and you go, and your treatment plan is?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So,
can you go over the x-ray findings, especially the AVN and the sclerosis that he's talking about, so that people who are listening and know what we're discussing here.
Right. So that the term AVN or avascular necrosis, often this is a condition, if we're seeing in a joint, it's typically in the hip, and various causes, being on steroids, prednisone,
high doses, the culprit,
is notorious.
Especially if it's bilateral.
Yeah, you think of, there's got to be a systemic
otherwise
problem.
It has to be a systemically related condition.
So, Ben, sorry, have you been on prednisone or some sort of anti-inflammatory steroid?
No, testosterone for about 20 years, anastrozole. I used to have a very low estrogen, but now I've taken a lot less estrogen over the last 5 years or so, and my estrogen level is about 24, which is a good level.
Right.
But for the last 20 years, I have been jogging, walking every single day in the forest, which is a lot of floors it's a lot of elevations, etc.
Right.
It's kind of hard on you, and when
not
I
even ground,
run.
Yeah.
When I've run over the years, sometimes I've felt so good that I've just really run fast.
Keep,
7 minute miles, that type of thing. And I'm just wondering if I've hurt myself.
Yeah, it's possible. Now, there could be this AVN condition of your hips is just idiopathic, which means we don't really know what it means or where it came from. So that's a possibility. I mean, sometimes I think there's probably a genetic predisposition. I've heard of this happening kind of without any known cause. You know, usually people who run long distances, typically the first thing we hear about is their knees, right? I mean, that's much more typical. Sounds like your knees aren't a problem.
Perfect. Yeah, my knees are perfect. And I've run long distances, the marathon, many times.
Right. Yeah, and Dr. Samir Umat's pointing out a few things that she is very how can I say, dexterously brought up on her laptop. But the main causes being trauma. So that's repetitive trauma is running. The other things, which, what are they? Alcoholism, sickle cell, steroid use. Sounds like all of these are really, there's pretty, probably not a factor in your situation, Ben.
No.
So, well, yeah, Caisson's disease. Oh, that would be, Caisson's disease is like the bends if we're, you know, if you've had, you know, deep sea diving and you come up and.
I used to deep sea dive. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you did?
Oh, really?
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Did you ever have the bends?
Any barometric trauma then?
Well, I don't know, but I was pretty aggressive in my 30s. But I was a PADI certified diver, and I would dive everywhere, sometimes very deep, 140 feet.
Wow.
Oh, my.
Wow.
Oh, my. Okay. So that's that would be a big question mark whether that. The barotrauma, as Dr. Umat referred to, would be, I mean, that would definitely be a cause, a potential cause of avascular necrosis.
Ben, do you also have any autoimmune disease or high cholesterol?
No, I take a cholesterol pill. My cholesterol, I just had the blood work the other day. My cholesterol was 100, and my LDL was like 50, and my HDL was 42.
So that's probably not a factor.
No, not.
So let's.
I have a very good diet.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, no red meat, mostly fish, fruits and vegetables.
Okay. So the good news, bad news. That's what we're cut to the chase, right? So what I'm, and of course, you're describing the X-ray. You're reading that out, and that's helpful. So the joint space is well preserved. That's the thing that stands out. So you are, in my opinion, not having seen you in person or seen the X-rays, you'd probably be an excellent candidate for stem cell injection therapy.
Okay.
The only other thing, and you know, I know some people have treated AVN with hyperbaric chambers. But I don't know if that's even a possibility, if it's ongoing late stage AVM, maybe not.
Good thought, Mina. You know, I've tried to convince Dr. Mixon to get one for us in
we
the
office.
Yeah,
we were talking about that last week.
I think you should get one. That would be great.
You know,
I've been lobbying for that, too.
Well, the only problem is the patient has to be in it for 1 hour. But I found some quick ones as well, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, but I think given that the joint space is well-preserved, that's an excellent prognostic indicator that stem cell therapy might work really well.
Yeah.
So I had a question.
We'll make an appointment with you.
Oh, sorry. Would osteopenia play a role in that too?
They usually would. Usually they... the radiologists would comment on the mineral.
That would be on there.
What they would call the density, you know, the bone density would be pretty obvious, typically on X-rays. So I'm sorry, Ben, you got to interrupt. You said something about appointment.
I'm going to make an appointment with you, but also the X-ray says that there's no flattening.
Right, another good thing. So that's another good thing that your the femoral head is probably nice. You know, looking like a nice ball and ball hitch kind of situation. So that's good. It sounds like it's, besides the AVN part, your hips are probably.
I guess
okay.
Ben's other big question is, can he continue to run or not? Doing
further
damage?
Or should I modify
damage?
Much less and maybe go to bicycle and rowing and things like that?
Yeah.
Well, this is a question that comes up a lot. It's like, I ask the patient, well, do you really, really love to run?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I want to get people back to doing what they love to do, whether it's golfing, gardening, playing with the grandchildren. I mean, that's part of the conversation. If they love to do it, so I think the stem cell thing is probably gives you the best chance to continue to do that. But you know, with the obvious advisement that you probably have to modify. I think the problem with running is it is traumatic on the joints, right? It is there's that impact load on the joints, and so I'm not my personal conviction is there's a lot of people that I recommend that they don't run if they're over the age of 50. I mean, there's people that are 90s that run marathons, but those are they're on the edge of the bell curve. Those are not normal people, so I'm not a big fan of repetitive impacts on the joints for, I think, like an elliptical
I'm 65 years old.
Okay. Still a young guy.
So it might be time for me to retire to bicycling and rowing.
Yeah. I think you might want to think about that, but, you know, that's all part of the conversation of, you know, what might be reasonable to do for sure.
I would also, you know, I mean, we were talking in joking, but I think hyperbaric oxygen was a very good thought on your part, Dr. Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
I think
yeah.
with stem cell therapy, I actually saw it when one of the patients we did PRP therapy with for the hair,
mm-hmm.
and she would schedule her PRP therapy with us and then go to another clinic where she could get hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And the two combined gave her better results.
Uh-huh.
So I think if Ben is looking for stem cell and it can help, great. But I think if he combines it with the hyperbaric oxygen therapy, he might get a better outcome.
Absolutely. No, I agree 100%. When I go to those regenerative medicine conferences, you know, they have the exhibition hall with all
yes,
the vendors.
Yeah.
And there's about two or three hyperbaric chamber
Wow.
Businesses
do.
Advertising
and
their wares.
And actually, last time I went, I was tempted to get in the chamber, but the lineup was so long.
Oh, wow.
You had to put your name
on the
list.
All the doctors were wanting to check it out.
Everybody was trying it out. I couldn't even get on the list.
Wow. So. I wonder if you could build one at home. Ooh. What do you think, Ken?
Nothing's impossible.
That's right. Ben, I hope we answered some of your questions today.
You did. And Dr. Nelson, I'll make an appointment on Monday. Thank you.
Beautiful. All right.
Good luck, man.
Very good. Leading Edge Medicine continues. We've got three callers on the line. Jackie, we're going to talk with you when we come right back to Leading Edge Medicine. Thank you for listening. Stay right there. There we go. We're back. Leading Edge Medicine. Good morning. I'm Lynette, along with Dr. Samira Umat, Dr. Dan Nelson, and Dr. Ken Pentland here. We have a few minutes left of our show. Let's get to the calls. In Kent, Jackie on the line. Hi there, Jackie.
Hello, Jackie.
Hello. This is the second time I've called with this question. But Dr. Mixon did not know the answer, and he suggested I call back when Dr. Nelson was in.
Oh, perfect. Perfect timing.
We were talking about you.
Yes.
We were hoping if you would call back. So there you are. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I had a fall, broke my darn neck, and went into surgery. And for some reason, when I'm coming out of surgery, they gave me fentanyl.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me 350 mcgs of fentanyl, and I went into a catatonic state.
Ooh.
And they called the Code Blue team, and they came in and started poking pins in my wrists and beating on my sternum and yelling in my face. And I was aware of everything that was going on. But I could not respond to them at all. So they took me in for a CT scan of my brain. And I heard the team say, she has brain activity. And so the doctor at that point ordered Narcan. I had two shots of Narcan to bring me out of the fentanyl overdose. So my question is, why do they use fentanyl when everything I hear is that it's a very bad drug? And then if you do get overdosed to the point of being catatonic, will it cause after effects? That's my two questions, Dr. Nelson.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I can answer. I mean, 350 micrograms of fentanyl at the end of a case like that sounds like a lot. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on your anesthesiologist because I wasn't there, so I'm not, you know, I don't want to be the Monday morning quarterback saying, oh, you know, he screwed up.
Quarterback.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that is a big slug of fentanyl. Now, fentanyl is a wonderful drug. except, of course, we've got this curse now in our country, which is terrible, yes. The fentanyl crisis.
Yes,
it's making headlines just about every day. It's unfortunate because it is a great adjunct for anesthesia. It's a very potent opioid, so, 100 times more potent than morphine.
When used for its purpose.
You use it in the operating room because, it's very helpful, but you need to be able to do things like support respirations by intubating the patient and putting them on a ventilator. I'm sorry.
What does it do?
So it binds to the opioid receptors throughout the body. And it reduces pain dramatically. So it does help smooth out the rough edges of a surgery and the anesthesia. What they call combination anesthesia. They use various things, not just one thing, but fentanyl is typically used. It's a very common thing to use as an adjunct with anesthesia. We call that balanced anesthesia, where we're not using just one. We're just not using a gas. We're not using, usually it's a combined technique that makes everything really better, makes it smoother, makes patients typically wake up quicker. In this case, obviously, that wasn't the case. So the other thing is side effects.
I think they were using it to try to wake me up. When I go under anesthesia, I stay for a very long time.
Yeah,
the fentanyl would not help wake you up,
though.
Oh, okay.
You would get narcotized, we would call that, if you have too much fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And that's what was going on. They gave you Narcan, which helps to reverse that. It's a competitive inhibitor of opioids, is naloxone or Narcan. So long-term side effects, is that what's the other part of the question of fentanyl?
Yes.
What kind of side effects are we talking about?
Could it cause neurological disorders?
I'm not aware of that. So what kind of neurologic disorder are you specifically?
I'm thinking something like Horner's disease, something like that. Mm. Or every once in a while it looks like I see something moving and I look and there's nothing there.
Okay, the first thing was Horner's disease? Horner's, like Horner's syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking? That's a droopy eye thing, and
correct.
I think the Horner's thing is probably more related to your neck surgery. That's my guess. Again, from the sideline, that's probably some sort of a nerve injury to the stellate ganglion during your surgery, and hopefully that will recover over time. And then you mentioned some visual issues you've seen.
It's not horrible, but it's just, I'm like, oh, I thought I saw a snake on the floor, but no.
I'm sure it's related to the surgery. I don't think any of this is related to the fentanyl, to be honest.
Fentanyl has a legitimate good use.
Most people would, the average person out there, they think fentanyl would be terrible, but it's actually a very good drug. And that fentanyl, there's something called sufentanyl, which is 10 times more potent than fentanyl.
Okay.
Carfentanyl, which is 100 times. They use that in veterinary anesthesia. Fentanyl is still a mainstay that's used in anesthesia.
When used
every day.
For its purpose, correctly.
When it's used medically correctly in a surgery situation, for sure.
Wow.
Well, answered something that I've been curious about for 2 years. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Oh,
thanks for the call. That was fun to talk about.
Thank you, Jackie. All right. We have time for one last call. And if we didn't get to your call today, you can call us on our next show starting at 10 o'clock. And the producer will give you that phone number. Dale, you may need to call us back on that show. But we're headed to Seattle. Robert is on the line. Hi, Robert.
Morning, Robert.
Hi, I have a question for the stomach guy.
Oh, yeah, the gut
and
specialist.
Is that me?
Yeah, I called a few weeks ago, and I talked to Dr. Mixon about it a little bit, and I thought I would talk to the stomach guy. But I had a recent colonoscopy, and I was diagnosed with what they called a mild amount of inflammation in the terminal ileum. And a lot of biopsies were done in the colonoscopy, and the The doctor basically said the colon looked normal, signs of active inflammation on a microscopic level, which is a nonspecific finding. Mm-hmm. And it said, overall, your presentation is consistent with mild Crohn's disease involving the small intestine. When I went to my doctor, the main symptoms are loose stools, and that seems to depend a lot on what I eat.
Yes.
So that diarrhea does. Nixon suggested resveratrol. I went to my doctor and the gastroenterologist, and he prescribed something, or he wanted to give me vedolizumab, which is a biologic. And Nixon didn't particularly like biologic, but I'm not sure whether they work or not. I keep reading all the PubMed stuff, and everybody disagrees. You know, vedolizumab is great. No, vedolizumab is terrible. You know, and 50-50, they contradict each other. So I have that loose stools. I have that diagnosis. One thing I cannot do is dairy, and I was going to try to repopulate my, you know, stomach with yogurt, but can't handle yogurt either. So what would you suggest that would help me?
There's a few things there to mention, but what was it that makes you can't handle yogurt?
Dairy.
Oh, you don't do dairy. Mm. Well, that makes sense, because that goes along
yogurt,
with my answer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So oftentimes we would see in the gut clinic that I worked at before, patients have come in that have had colonoscopy and were showing some kind of microscopic or microcytic colitis. Oftentimes these patients would also have things like ear infections as a child, tonsillitis, asthma, or strep throat repeatedly as a child. We would often do food sensitivity testing for these patients, and about 80% of the time, dairy would come up as a sensitivity. Now, the difference between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, ulcerative colitis starts from the bottom up, and Crohn's kind of can be anywhere throughout the GI. So the fact that it's in the small intestine is consistent with that. But then it could also be anywhere else along that track. So also the fact that the small intestine is involved suggests that is more likely to suggest that food is part of the problem, right? Because that's where most of the nutrients from food gets absorbed. So my recommendation would be, well, you already know dairy is a problem. I would get a food sensitivity test to see what else is a problem. And the first step is to eliminate causes of inflammation. Second step is to support recovery.
And so, you know, causes of inflammation may also include things like caffeine and alcohol. And so a food sensitivity test, I think, Ken, is a very good idea, because patient may not know of what other things you are sensitive to. So that's a good way to start. Lactose intolerance is very common, and it is a trigger food. What about fiber? Is fiber a good thing for him?
That's a good point.
Can I just ask about the food sensitivity test and what's involved with that?
That's a good question. There's several points here. So a food sensitivity test is a blood test, and it's linking at IgA and IgG antibodies, as opposed to IgE, which is a different
mechanism. Totally different, yeah.
Right. So and what was the other point, Samira?
The food sensitivity fiber in terms of treatment, and also, you know, his question, and we're running short of time, that's why I'm kind of rushing a little bit. Your question was biologics. My personal feeling would be that I would save the biologics for when I really needed them.
Right, because you go off of them, when you go back on, they're not as effective.
Yeah. So I would do everything else early on to kind of control symptoms. If you know of stress is a big cause, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, over-the-counter medications, even some supplements and foods. And so I would control all of those that are within my grasp to control first. And then I would reserve the biologics for a little bit later in case things really get flared up and active and nothing else is controlling
Absolutely.
It. That's when I would go to the biologics.
The yogurt question? Since I can't take yogurt,
don't take
probiotic. How do I repopulate the gut without yogurt?
Exactly. Yeah, it's probiotics can be helpful, but they probably won't be a cure. And there's also a difference between a lactose intolerance and a dairy sensitivity. One is a lack of an enzyme to break down sugar in milk. The other is an immune system reaction to proteins in milk. So that will all be sort of discussed if you come in for a food sensitivity test.
Yeah, and Robert, that is the sound of our music, meaning the show is ended. If you want to talk about this topic more, ask our producer. Mm-hmm. He'll give you the phone number of our next show, okay?
That'd be great. Yeah, I have a question.
All right. Very good. Well, that's it. Wow, lots of topics today on Leading Edge Medicine. I'm Lynette, and have a great rest of your weekend. We'll be back again next weekend with Dr. Umat, and I believe we'll have Dr. Michael Gilbert in talking about the eyes and aging. And Dr. Ken Pentland will return as well. We can continue talking about your gut health. And don't forget, our heart health event is coming up at all three longevity clinics on May 9th. That's a Thursday, but you do have to sign up to get information at 1-866-86-YOUNG. Have a great day.